You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Emmanuel Rosen, author of the new memoir, If Anyone Calls, Tell Them That I Died. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. As we begin to reopen our synagogue, Beit Simcha, here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, planning for our first Oneg Shabbat this week, the first one in well over 13 months, I've been reflecting on just what it is that creates real Jewish community. While synagogues focus on the traditional unifying elements of diaspora Judaism, prayer, study, social justice work, and personal and social connection, there are limitations on how effective these activities can be in bringing together an increasingly diverse American Jewish community. The pandemic experience of the past year and change has both emphasized that challenge and highlighted some hidden strengths of Jewish religious community at the same time. And that's worth exploring for the lessons it can teach. Being somewhat aware of the world around me, I realize most non-Orthodox Jews in America today don't pray regularly, and that Jewish study is typically limited to children, adolescents, and retired adults, with a giant age chasm between those. I also know that for many Jews in the United States, most, to be honest, a variety of other preoccupations usually focus our attention far more than our religious affiliation as Jews. We are more likely to know about our favorite sports teams or Netflix shows than we are about the Torah portion of the week, and politics obsesses us far more than Shabbos. The result is that while people certainly consider themselves to be Jews, I mean, they are, and may be proud of being Jewish, most of them aren't active in their Jewish communities. For the minority of Jews, well under 50% of the total number in most communities, who are active in the Jewish community itself, a nearly obsessive focus on Israel and Israel-related issues, whichever side of the right-left divide you fall on, often takes all the Jewish attention we have to spare. When Jewish holidays roll around, as they do quite often, the majority of Jews in America may take a little time to set up and run a Passover Seder. They might light Hanukkah candles and fry latkes. It's even possible a fair number of American Jews choose to go to temple on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. But it's also possible they just might not, of course. Without synagogues, Judaism would quite literally disappear in a generation. But most American Jews take synagogues for granted, viewing them as optional institutions to be used for things like bar mitzvahs or occasional service attendance for somebody's anniversary blessing, maybe a child or grandchild's class's Shabbat service. Perhaps they can be persuaded to go to a Purim or Simchat Torah celebration, you know, to sample genuine Jewish joy. But weekly Sabbath service attendance is not something most non-Orthodox American Jews even conceive of, let alone participate in. But there is one oddity in all of this. When Jews do actually attend services on a Friday night or Saturday morning, whether or not the service connects with them spiritually, intellectually, or even religiously, if there is food served afterwards, by golly, they'll hang around and chat with other Jews and their partners for a very, very long time. That is, the social institution of gathering after praying and hearing a sermon or a Torah reading to eat, drink, and schmooze is so compelling that often people stick around longer at the Oneg Shabbat or the Kiddush than the entire time that the service took. The process of celebrating Sabbath is much more about the warm human interaction while munching on a bagel and lox or eating bakery cookies than it is a deeply spiritual experience. Or maybe that, in fact, is the deep spiritual experience. By no means am I denigrating the process of prayer, which I've been involved in leading professionally for well over 40 years, since I was a mid-teenager, in fact, and it has been my personal commitment over the entirety of my career as a cantor and rabbi to strive always to make prayer fresh, interesting, varied, and authentic in a variety of meaningful ways every Friday and Saturday. That's been true even over the last 14-plus months of COVID-19 Facebook Live services, too. While we have always had a small gathering of masked congregants in person at Beit Simcha, my congregation, most of our Shabbat attendees since March of 2020 have been on Facebook. Of course, something has been missing, and that something is the warm human interaction that truly lies at the heart of Jewish community. It's the hanging around, eating, meeting, talking with old friends and new acquaintances, catching up on lives, sharing not only challah and a schnapps, but how much we miss our kids, or where we are going to travel, or the most interesting book we've read, or whether Shtissel will have another season, or why we fell in love with Mrs. Maisel, or just how Netanyahu keeps holding on to power. You know, I'm not sure if Oneg Shabbats and Kiddushes will save American Judaism from its general loss of interest and commitment. But I do know that the more of that kind of post-service Jewish community we generate and foster, the better the experience of sharing our lives and a meal in person after prayer and study, well, the more of that there is, the stronger the relationships we will create. And real community is what we have been craving desperately for the past year. I promise, as we begin to have an Oneg Shabbat, carefully and hygienically after Friday night services at my own synagogue, Beit Simcha, pouring Kiddush after Saturday morning services, we will foster exactly that warm Shabbat feeling we've all been missing in our lives and that we can't really get anywhere else. Frankly, I can't wait. To play us in this morning on the theme of joy in Judaism, here's Mordechai Shapiro singing Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, celebrate God with joy. Why, that's the theme of my very own congregation.
Elo simcho shel mitzvah. Oh, boy, you lefanav, v'nana. Boy, you lefanav, v'nana. Ivdu es Hashem b'simcho. Boy, you lefanav, v'nana, v'nana, nana, nana. Ivdu es Hashem b'simcho. Boy, you lefanav, v'nana, v'nana, nana, nana. Boy, you lefanav, v'nana.
That was Mordechai Shapiro singing Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, serve God with joy, celebrating the return of in-person Shabbat celebrations after services. When we come back on Two Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Manuel Manu Rosen explains how his German-born Jewish grandfather experienced life in Israel, the complex family legacy he left for his children and grandchildren to unravel. Learn all about it when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson of the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall. In our own building, services, classes, and events are open to everyone once again. Join us in person Friday night or Saturday morning or both by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. We will continue to hold our services with full music, both in person and by virtual experience weekly. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are available on Zoom and in blended format. You can access those. Email me, BeitSimchaTucson.org, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. All classes, as well as our wonderful religious school, are available in person and on Zoom. In fact, for more information about Beit Simcha to attend services, enroll in our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course, all of our services on Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest, most exciting, and fastest-growing Jewish community in southern Arizona in its wonderful beginning years. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish our guest this morning. Emmanuel Manu Rosen has written a fascinating memoir called If Anyone Calls, Tell Them I Died. I think I'm going to let you introduce it. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Yeah, thank you, Rabbi Sam. The book is about my grandfather, who was a lawyer in Germany, a successful lawyer. In 1933, after Hitler took power, he was notified that he could no longer be a lawyer in Germany because he was Jewish. So my grandparents decided to pack everything and move to Tel Aviv. Now, in 1956, 23 years after they moved, my grandparents went back to Germany for a couple of months. And upon their return to Tel Aviv, my grandfather took his own life. He jumped to his death. Now, growing up, I had no idea about all this. Actually, the title of my book, If Anyone Calls, Tell Them I Died, is something my mom used to say before her afternoon nap. So it was kind of a joke. And I had a very happy childhood. But after my mom died, I found a box with letters. And these were letters that my grandparents had sent her from that 1956 trip. So I became really curious. Maybe they have the key to why my grandfather decided to die. And I had these translated because I don't read German, and they were in German. And then I went to Germany. I actually retraced their journey. I stayed in the same hotels, took the same trains. And then in the city of Hamm, Westphalia, where my grandfather was actually a lawyer, I found out, I received a folder, a thick folder, and I found out that a few years after the suicide, my mom initiated a lawsuit against the German authorities claiming that those who expelled him from his profession and from his cultural environment were responsible for his death. So the book is me traveling to Germany, following my grandparents, and about this lawsuit initiated by my mom.
It's an incredible psychological journey in a way. You had no idea, you know, why your grandfather had committed suicide, of course, right?
That's correct. And for most of my life, until I was almost 40, I didn't know that he committed suicide.
So we will explore much more the really fascinating things you found out. And if anyone calls, tell them I died. We'll be back with Manu Rosen in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, TooJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about a story that came out in the news about the last Jew in Afghanistan, a man named Simon Tov, who's been protecting the synagogue, traced a little bit of the 25 or 2,600-year-old history of the Jews of Afghanistan and their kind of center around Balkh and the north of Afghanistan, which was Bactria. I think that's as far as we got.
Oh, we got to Herat.
Ah, thank you very much.
Which was the next big center of Afghan Jewry.
And it's on the Silk Route or near the Silk Route?
Yes, and it's the original hometown of this Zvulun Simon Tov. It turns out Simon Tov is a very common Jewish name throughout Central Asia, in Uzbekistan, in Turkmenistan, in Afghanistan. So we'll come back to that name and that family a little bit later, if that's okay.
Sure.
But in the interim, I want to say that just about exactly 10 years ago, archaeologists found in one of the caves abandoned by the Taliban in eastern Afghanistan something that is now called the Afghan Geniza, named after the famous Geniza of Cairo. And it's a treasure trove of documents from the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries, written some in Hebrew, some in Aramaic, some in Judeo-Persian, and some even in Judeo-Arabic, sort of reflecting the diversity of the community that was once Afghan Jewry, roots in Iraq, roots in Iran, and roots deeply embedded in Central Asia. We also have records from a 12th century Islamic traveler who kept a journal of a large, flourishing Jewish quarter in Kabul. So we know the community in Kabul goes back at least that far. But for many centuries, it was kind of second place to the Jewish community of Herat, almost in the same way that, you know, Washington, D.C. is our national capital. But what's our biggest city and
New
what's
York.
Our biggest Jewish community?
Of course.
New York.
Yeah,
so Herat was like their New York and Kabul was like their Washington, D.C. In the course of the 20th century, the community grew and shrank dramatically multiple times. It was a real roller coaster. It grew when there were refugee crises in neighboring parts of the Soviet Union, like Tajikistan or Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan, when things got too tough for Jews there, they fled over the border to people who speak similar languages and have similar customs in Afghanistan. And Afghans are legendary for their hospitality, and no one more so than the Jews there. And when there were refugee crises in Iran, when the Shah came to power and there were fundamentalist issues, whatever. After Israel established its statehood in 1948, the Jews in Afghanistan were kind of in limbo until 1951, when they were officially allowed to leave for wherever they wanted, for points unspecified. Most of them moved to Israel. Some of them went to Queens, New York, where there's a community of about 1,000 families from Afghanistan. And some went to London, Paris, or Marseille. And before we go any further, I just want to say that this community is neither Ashkenazic nor Sephardic. And most Americans, in fact, people from the Americas in general, if they're Jewish, make the mistake of thinking that the Jewish world is divided into two binary categories, Sephardic, Ashkenazic. We've talked about this before. To be Sephardic, you have to be descended from a family that once lived in Spain or Portugal. Otherwise, you may live in Yemen or Egypt or Iraq or Iran or Afghanistan, and you may not have a drop of Ashkenazic blood, nobody who ever spoke Yiddish or ate gefilte fish in your family, but you are neither Ashkenazic nor Sephardic. You are from the Edot HaMizrach,
right,
the communities of the
Jews,
East.
Right.
And Afghanistan is a prime example of this. We'll come back to very modern Afghan Jewish history next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A little old lady sells pretzels on a street corner for a dollar each. Every day a guy leaves his office building at lunchtime, and as he passes the old lady's pretzel stand, he leaves her a dollar, but he never takes a pretzel. This goes on for 3 years. The two of them never speak, just each day he puts down that dollar. One day, as the man passes the old lady's stand, leaving his dollar as usual, the pretzel lady says, "Hey, they're $2 now." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a new definition of chutzpah, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Emor, our portion this week in Leviticus, begins as so many others do. God gives commands to the people of Israel. But the language this time is different. Usually, commandments begin with the Hebrew word daber, speak to the children of Israel. Occasionally, it's tzav, command the children of Israel. But this time, the much softer word emor, say to the priests, the children of Aaron, is used. Why? There's a clue in the continuation of the first sentence of our portion. The Seder actually begins, say to the priests, and then adds, and say to them. The commentators don't believe the Torah is ever truly redundant, so the Talmud teaches that there's a subtle message here. Be cautious in how we adults speak to children. Emor means to speak softly, kindly. Good advice in teaching children at any time. But why specifically is this word emor used twice in regard to the priestly commands? Priests, after all, are not children. Perhaps the essence lies in the central message of holiness given to our ancestors, articulated so forcefully at the start of last week's portion of Kedoshim. You shall all be holy, for I, God, am holy. Here in Emor, as the specifics of the designated representatives of the people in holiness are articulated, the change to softer language is notable. The priests are the ones who actually have to help the people achieve holiness. They must be given the careful, scrupulous requirements, but also inspired to do that priestly work with devotion and passion. there will be a balance to maintain between conscientious, obsessive attention to detail and finding a way to communicate the sacredness of their calling to the Jewish people, who are not as occupied with its processes and may not be as emotionally invested in it as they are. Thus, the word used here is emor, speak, explain, teach, inspire, not simply daber, tell, command, order, require. In leading anyone towards holiness, there must be a serious, conscientious devotion to quality. Badly performed rituals inspire no one, but there must also be a demonstrated process of caring about the way those processes are experienced by the devotees, even, perhaps especially, a love for the process and the result. This week of Emor, may we be inspired to seriously and caringly seek holiness in our lives through Jewish practice, and also seek to inspire others to do so. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Manu Rosen, tells us how he went from being a Silicon Valley marketing star to exploring the complicated history of a family legal case in Germany that has affected him and, well, his entire family for generations. Hear all about it when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel and Syria exchanged missile attacks last week after Damascus launched an advanced surface-to-air missile that landed all the way in the Negev Desert, aimed at the Israeli secret nuclear facility at Dimona in the south of Israel. Alarms sounded in Abu Krinat near Dimona. Syria fired the missile, responding to what it claims was an Israeli Air Force bombing near Damascus. Israel frequently strikes Syria to prevent Iranian entrenchment in the country, as well as weapons shipments to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Reports from across Israel, including central Israel and Jerusalem, spoke of loud explosions that shook houses. The IDF activated its air defense systems in an attempt to intercept the missile, but failed. The military is investigating why its air defenses did not succeed in intercepting the SA-5 missile, and did not intercept the larger warhead. Earlier reports indicated the explosion was a result of a Patriot missile defense system battery responding to the firing of the missile. The IDF later confirmed reports and said missile parts were located in the swimming pool of the Negev community of Ashalim. Due to a surface-to-air missile entering Israeli territory, air defense systems were activated, said the IDF. The Patriot missiles were reportedly launched from somewhere near Dimona, not far from the location of the quote-unquote secret nuclear reactor. The IDF said that in response to the launch, it then attacked several missile batteries in Syria, including the one that fired the projectile that struck its territory. Syria's state news agency said Syrian air defenses intercepted the Israeli attack that targeted areas in the Damascus suburbs. Air defenses intercepted the rockets and downed most of them, the agency said. However, 4 Syrian soldiers were wounded in the attack, and material damage did take place. A Syrian military defector said the Israeli strikes targeted locations near the town of Dumayr, about 40 kilometers northeast of Damascus, where Iranian-backed militias are located. It's an area Israel has hit repeatedly in past attacks. In Washington, a bipartisan group of 328 members of Congress sent a letter last week to the Appropriations Committee voicing support for robust funding for Israel's security without added conditions. The move comes 3 days after the speeches of Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders during the J Street conference that said the administration should consider putting conditions on aid to Israel. The letter was spearheaded by Representative Ted Deutch, Democrat from Florida, Chairman of the Middle East, North Africa, and Global Counterterrorism Subcommittee, and Representative Michael McCaul, a Republican from Texas, the lead Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. There should be no doubt of where Congress stands in our support for Israel's security after an overwhelming majority of Democrats and Republicans signed on to support full funding of security assistance to our closest Middle East ally, said Deutsch. This letter clearly demonstrates Republicans and Democrats in Congress stand together, opposing conditions on our security assistance to Israel, said McCall. The U.S. stands with our friend and ally Israel in promoting our shared national security goals abroad. We remain committed to providing Israel with the necessary security aid to protect itself. We strongly believe robust U.S. foreign assistance is vital to ensuring our national security interests abroad, the letter goes on. One program that enjoys particularly strong bipartisan backing and for which we, Democrats and Republicans, urge your continued strong support is the full funding of security assistance to Israel. Israel continues to face direct threats from Iran and its terrorist proxies, they wrote. American security assistance to Israel helps counter these threats. Our rock-solid security partnership serves as a deterrent against even more significant attacks on our shared interests. Congress is committed to maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge and its ability to defend itself by itself against persistent threats. Our aid to Israel is a vital and cost-effective expenditure which advances important U.S. national security interests in a highly challenging region. As America's closest Mideast ally, Israel regularly provides the U.S. with unique intelligence information and advanced defensive weapons systems. We recognize that not every member of Congress will agree with every policy decision of every Israeli government, they concluded. The members quoted President Joe Biden's opposition to conditioning aid. Reducing funding or adding conditions on security assistance would be detrimental to Israel's ability to defend itself against all threats, the congressman's letter concludes. And the Israeli electoral crisis process grinds on with no clear end in sight. The latest rumors have Naftali Bennett, the Zionist right-wing modern Orthodox leader of a seven-seat coalition, that's tiny, forming a national unity government with Yair Lapid of the centrist party and his lefter-wing allies in a power-sharing arrangement that would finally remove Bibi Netanyahu from power as prime minister after over a decade. This seems an unlikely proposal to succeed, but who knows? The other, maybe even more likely outcome, is a fifth national election in a little over 2 years, with more of the same to come.
דובר צהל מודיע כי היום, סמוך לשער 2 בצהריים, פתחו הכוחות המצריים והסוריים בהתקפה בסיני וברמת הגולן, וכוחותינו פועלים נגד התוקפים. כתבינו מוסרים כי בשל פעולות של מטוסים סוריים בגזרת רמת הגולן, נשמעות ברחבי הארץ צפירות עולות ויורדות, אלה הן צפירות אמת.
And in Israel, the end of an era, the Israel Defense Forces and the Defense Ministry came to an agreement last week that Army radio should be shut down, following a period of deliberation on the future of the military radio station. For many years, the IDF-run station carried news during critical periods in Israel that everyone in the whole nation listened to, especially during times of war. During the Yom Kippur War in 1973, IDF Radio was the first Israeli radio station to broadcast around the clock, and everybody was boy glued to it. Fortunately, Galatz, as IDF Radio is known, has become an anachronistic reminder of the days when Israel's very existence was constantly threatened. It will now pass into history, you know, kind of like all the accordions that were the basis of Israeli patriotic music for so many years.
We can take it to the end of the line. There's nothing I can do. A total eclipse of the heart.
And finally, Jim Steinman, the songwriter who helped create Meatloaf and wrote Total Eclipse of the Heart and a whole lot of other hits for groups like Air Supply, Bonnie Tyler, Barry Manilow, Celine Dion, and of course, that whole bat out of hell routine for Meatloaf. Jim Steinman passed away last week. A Jewish kid from Hewlett, New York, Jim Steinman graduated from Amherst, writing music for Bertolt Brecht plays, later worked for Joe Papp, moved on to musical theater, and contributed to the 1970s and 80s and even 90s rock and roll and pop scenes in a big way. I hate to say it, but the musical that they made out of Meatloaf songs was quite possibly the worst show I've ever seen. But Steinman's songs were hooky, with great lyrics and huge, complicated arrangements. For a guy who loved vampires, this may sound strange, but still, may he rest in peace. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Emmanuel Manu Rosen has written a book, a memoir, If Anyone Calls, Tell Them I Died. Really, it's the story of his grandfather, the story of displacement, the story of the way that having to reorient your life in a completely new world is never quite as easy as people like to make it out to be. We began earlier in the show talking about how your grandfather committed suicide. You didn't even know he had committed suicide until much later. When you went back to Germany to kind of retrace the experience, found where he had practiced law, what his experience had been, tell us what surprises you found along the way.
Well, my first surprise was from my reaction, because it was only the second time I went to Germany, and I will never forget my first day when I arrived in the hotel that they stayed. I went downstairs and I started hearing German, obviously all around me, but also in my head, and all these words in German that I didn't understand their meaning, because my grandmother never learned Hebrew. And she spoke to me in German, but I guess not enough for me to understand.
It didn't stick in any case.
It didn't stick, exactly. But so that was one interesting experience. But then the biggest surprise on the trip itself was when I received that folder in Hamm, the city where he practiced law, and I found out that my mom actually initiated that lawsuit against the German authorities, that they were responsible for his death. Now, then I had to take it back to California and had someone translate to me all the correspondence and the proceedings. So that was definitely my biggest surprise. Later on, in California, I had I would call it a shock, not a surprise, when I found out that the expert witness that the court assigned in the 60s during this trial was, during Nazi time, a Nazi who sent mentally ill people to their death as part of improving, quote unquote, the Aryan race. I couldn't believe it, but it was true. So, and apparently these types of things happened. I don't know to what extent, but they did happen during the 60s. So that was the second surprise that I encountered in my research.
You know, trying to find justice in a Germany that was somewhere split between paying a lot of reparations and wanting to sweep things under the rug, it was a very courageous thing for your brother to do, but not an easy thing.
It was definitely not easy, and also it took a long time. I mean, the whole proceeding, the whole thing from the first claim till the trial ended took more than 7 years. Now, it was very important to her, I think, and she was very persistent. And also, I think, in some ways, she worked for a lawyer, who dealt with reparations and restitution, so she had the access. I always think about people who didn't know that much about law and just gave up quickly, or some people probably never even filed lawsuits, and you know, you hear about really horrible stories of people who suffered not only greatly during Nazi time, but also in the years that followed.
Did she find justice, really?
I think that she felt that, yes, there was justice was done to some extent because, and I know that from her visit to Germany. She was in Germany only twice in her life. She refused to go for many years. She left it at age 11 when back in 1933. But I know that what she wrote to us after that trip, that she felt, that some justice was done with the Germans accepting, essentially, responsibility for his death.
I want to talk a little bit about German Jews in Israel. You know, the stereotype from early on, the term Yekke comes from the fact that they were so much more formal. The old jokes about, please pass me the brick, Herr Professor, certainly Herr Doktor, you know, that kind of stuff. This was quite an adaptation. The cultures couldn't have been more different, could they?
Yeah, and it was an interesting community. Of course, you know, there is a range of reactions. There are some German Jews, some Yekkes, who were very successful in industry, in agriculture, in society. Some of them became judges, and actually the three judges in the Eichmann trial were originally from Germany.
From Germany, right.
Yeah, they were born in Germany, but they were much younger than my grandfather, and there were among them also people like my grandfather, who never felt that they belonged in Palestine or later in Israel, and they had the thing is they lived in kind of clusters. That's why my grandmother never spoke Hebrew, I think, or part of the reason, because she didn't really need to, because everyone around her spoke German, or at least understand, if they spoke Yiddish, they could understand what she was saying, replied in Yiddish, they managed. And my grandmother, by the way, she, although she faced hardship, obviously, and then later her husband committed suicide, which is very difficult. And, you know, she had the guilty feelings, et cetera. But she felt very much Israeli. And I think this trip made her feel even more Israeli than my grandfather. And you sense it in her letters. You know, in her letters she texts, she says things like, us Israelis, or our Israeli kids look so much healthier than the German kids. And my grandfather, in his language, in the letters, is more detached. So that's also, I found that interesting, that different people reacted differently to the displacement.
So I have to ask you a question. You had a very successful career in Silicon Valley. You wrote a national bestseller, Anatomy of a Buzz. This is quite a departure from marketing association books and analyzing all of that. How was it to dig back and do this kind of writing? It's very different.
Yeah, definitely very different. It was obviously more difficult emotionally, especially at the early days of research when I discovered all these things about my family. But at the same time, it was, this is the most important book I've written. You know, it's very important to me. And I'm really glad I told this story of my mom and my grandparents. The marketing books you write, of course you care about the topic, you have a reason you write it, but it's very, very different.
In writing this, you know, if anyone called someone, by the way, I have to say, not a very typical book that I start to read, you know, skim it, and then end up reading the whole thing. It's a very compelling story. And it's written in a very accessible style. So I want to compliment you on that. But there's a lot of depth in this exploration. This must have challenged you in some unusual ways.
Yes, and you know, one interesting thing that happened in the process of writing it, that most of the trip itself I did around 2003, and then I sat down and I wrote the book. I hand-wrote the book in Hebrew. That kind of was the most natural way it came, and I wrote a very thick book that is very different than what you read. But it was good because I also managed to give it to some people in the family to read and fact-check, etc. And then years later, then I got involved in other book projects, and then a few years ago, I came back to that manuscript because I really wanted to tell this story, and that allowed me some perspective, and I wrote a very different book based on this initial manuscript in Hebrew.
In exploring this, did you make any new connections within the family? I wondered about that.
Yes, I made new connections, I always kept in touch with people, but that definitely intensified the connection with my uncle, who lived in Israel still, and other people. My uncle, by the way, is another side story, which I never spoke with him too much about it because he worked for the Mossad, and he was actually headed one of the units of the Mossad to hunt down Nazi criminals, because he was born in Germany, spoke German at home. He was 7 years old when they left for Tel Aviv. So I spoke with him not necessarily about that, although he told me a few things. He was also involved not in the capturing itself of Eichmann, but in the process that led to it. So fascinating connections. I have to say that I also made new connections in Germany, and I made some friends. You know, there is also a version of the book in German, and the people who helped me translate it, or I should say, they translated it, and I. But they checked a lot of things with me. We really became friends, and in that sense, there are some good connections, I think, that came out of it.
What was the most surprising thing that you discovered in writing? If anyone calls, tell them I died.
Well, beyond the two things that I already said, which
sure.
are that folder, the lawsuit, and the Nazi psychiatrist who
was testifying to your grandfather's state of mind,
which is unbelievable. I mean, I still can't get over it. He was the one who had to determine whether there was a connection between the events in 1933, you know, the persecution and the suicide. But I was one thing that I was really surprised has to do with my uncle, again, going back to that.
The uncle who worked for the Mossad.
Exactly. And after he died, I read a newspaper article in Israel that said that he was also in charge of the contact with Fritz Bauer. Now, Fritz Bauer was the district attorney in the state of Hessen. He was a German Jew who stayed in Germany, and he was actually the one who provided Israel with information about the whereabouts of Adolf Eichmann. So, and I never knew that Rafi, my uncle, was part of this, and that was an amazing discovery. And when I was sitting there with the German team that was translating the book, we were talking about this in the morning, and then in the afternoon, one of the translators came with a stamp that was just issued a couple of days earlier in honor of Fritz Bauer. Uh-huh. So there were kind of all these little and big surprises throughout the research and writing the book.
The book is called If Anyone Calls, Tell Them I Died. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book, to get the book?
Well, the book itself sells wherever books are sold, including Amazon.
Of course.
I have a website with all my contact information. It's emmanuel-rosen.com, and I spell Emmanuel with one M. And I love hearing from people always.
Thank you so much. It's a terrific book, highly recommended, a fascinating story. And now I think you should write a book about your uncle who was in the Mossad. I think that's...
if only I knew everything.
You will never know everything, I suspect.
Maybe I can invent things, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi, so much.
You're very welcome. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rabbi Kerry Olitsky, longtime expert on Jewish outreach, discussing his new series of children's books. Our playout this morning comes from Karen Pellis, a beautiful arrangement of her song Bata Li Pitom, You Came to Me Suddenly, sung last year across all the distances we experienced. And now we can begin to come together once again. Don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha starting this very Friday night for services and an Oneg Shabbat. Just be sure to email me to confirm, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
זו כמעט הייתה שעת בין הארבעים של חיי אבל את באת לי פתאום באת אליי פתאום ואמרת לי בואי אלוהים שומר מקום בקצה היום אנשים כמו תמימות כמוני כמעט שקעתי אבל את באת לי פתאום ועבר כבר זמן מאז התחלתי במסע שלי עד כאן אין חרטות כי היה מעולם וכבר כמעט נגמלתי
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.